Welcome to the Accelerators Podcast. We're bringing you oncology news and views with guests from all over the field. The discussions on this show are not medical advice, and they represent our own opinions and not those of our employers. The Accelerators is part of the Photon Media family of podcasts. You can check out all of our shows at photonmedia.org.
What is up? This is Matt Spraker from the Accelerators Podcast. I'm a radiation oncologist, and I'm coming to you solo today, actually, from Denver, Colorado. So I'm actually trying out a new concept today, an experiment, so to speak. It's been a very exciting year in radiation oncology in terms of policy. There's a lot that's happened with our specialty societies, and then there's a lot of attention being paid both in and outside of radiation oncology to changes or potential changes in Medicare. If you spend any time online, you probably know that there's lots of calls to get engaged. And there's a lot of young physicians like us out there that are, wanting to try to make some changes to the medical system for the betterment of our jobs and for our patients. Recently, I did an advocacy day with ACRO and United Specialists for Patient Access, a multi-specialty group. Talk about that in a minute. But what I really liked about that day was that they provided a lot of background information that allowed me to understand the context and all of the issues surrounding the bills that we were advocating for on this day. That was new for me, and I really appreciated that. But as I was trying to learn about everything, I noticed that it really just takes a lot of time. The information is freely available, but it's not super well organized. So if you want to read deeply on these topics and greatly understand the medical system and how policy impacts that system, very complicated. It just takes a while. Physicians also have competing priorities, so I thought maybe here's an unmet need. Love that term. Anyway, I'm going to try to make a series of short, efficient podcast episodes. Maybe it'll just be one. We'll see how it goes. Basically around current events and giving you important context that you need to know to be able to be part of the conversation surrounding healthcare policy inside and outside radiation oncology. So without further ado, here is my unnamed policy podcast experiment quick episode. So just some quick disclosures and disclaimers. I'm a community employed hospital-employed radiation oncologist in Denver, Colorado. I don't hold any leadership roles, and I'm not speaking on behalf of any society or any particular policy group. I'm literally just a dude learning about this stuff and then telling you what I learned in an efficient manner. That's the goal here. Also, of course, this is just my opinion. I'm still learning, and I would love to hear from all of you if there are corrections or things that you feel like should be discussed more thoroughly or in a different way or debated. I would love that. So as I mentioned before, I recently did an advocacy day for radiation oncology, and I really enjoyed it. It was actually a multi-specialty advocacy day that focused on specialties that have a lot of procedures and high equipment costs. So like, for example, one of the meetings I advocated with a vascular surgeon that was in my region. The day was put on by United Specialists for Patient Access. It's a advocacy group. ACRO is part of it, as well as like Elekta and Boston Scientific and some other companies that you'd be aware of. And it was administered by Liberty Partners, which is a consulting group that helps ACRO and I believe other organizations with advocacy on the Hill. So shout out to all these groups. I really enjoyed the advocacy day. And again, I think the resources that you provided were fantastic, and they inspired me to kind of learn more about the current status of these issues going on in Medicare. So the two bills that we advocated for during this advocacy day had to do with Medicare payment to physicians, and the focus was on freestanding practices. And I'll explain what that means in a few minutes. But the two bills we were advocating for, just so if you want to go look them up, are HR 2474, which is Strengthening Medicare for Patients and Providers Act, and HR 3674, Providing Relief and Stability for Medicare Patients Act of 2023. My understanding is that both of these bills, if enacted, would amend the Medicare final rule for next year. So before we dive into the specifics, I think this is a good opportunity to talk about just a brief history of Medicare. I encourage you to go read this. It's very interesting and pretty complicated, but here are kind of the highlights. So Medicare was enacted in 1965. It was signed by Lyndon Johnson. And this was the first time that the government kind of passed legislation that implied that the federal government was financially responsible for providing healthcare, at least to the elderly. President Harry Truman and his wife, First Lady Bess Truman, were actually the first recipients of Medicare insurance in our country. I didn't know that. Also, there's really a big story about how Medicare helped desegregate hospitals, especially in the South. This is actually pretty interesting. I heard a little bit about this before, but there's a documentary called Power to Heal, Medicare and the Civil Rights Revolution. It's actually narrated by Danny Glover, and it's all about just kind of this epic saga of how Medicare and the government sort of forced desegregation of hospitals using the carrot and stick of the Medicare funding that was available for hospitals that participated, but they had to be compliant with the regulations. And due to other legislation prior to Medicare was passed, that was a requirement. So pretty cool overall. So who administers Medicare? It's administered by CMS. I feel like a lot of people know that. It's a division of Health and Human Services, and they basically administer the program as we see it. They make the regulations and things like that. The SSA, the Social Security Administration, actually determines eligibility. And then within this whole group, each year there's a chief actuary of Medicare that has to present accounting info to a medical board of trustees about the health of the program. And then the trustees by law are required to issue reports that the public can then see. Now, there's a lot of people involved that are not government employees or parts of the government. I'm calling them influencers, and this is definitely not a complete list. And I'm guessing there's a lot of controversy here and a lot of people that really have loud voices in the decisions that get made inside CMS. But two that are often named that you should be aware of are the Specialty Society Relative Value Scale Update Committee, or the RUC. You definitely will hear people talk about this in radiation oncology. This is a group of physicians representing the AMA, and they primarily help Medicare set rates for some of the parts of their payment programs. And so basically, it's like if you're a radiation oncologist and you look at a cone beam CT, there's actually a payment amount that is associated with that code. And that code, the payment, is actually set by a collaboration between the RUC and people in Medicare and other parties.
The AMA actually posts a list of the specialties that participate in the RUC. Each has a representative. A lot of the specialties have rotating members. Radiation oncology doesn't have a seat on the RUC, but internal medicine does. And some of our other surgeon oncologist colleagues, also their societies are represented on the RUC.
So if you go read a lot about this, you'll inevitably come across the fact that the RUC are physicians, and they're basically making recommendations to Medicare about how their own services should be valued. So an obvious conflict, but that's the system, and it has worked well. And there's been a lot of changes to the system kind of incrementally to try to make sure that this part isn't an issue. But nevertheless, this is a group that has heavy influence on these codes and their prices. I think I saw one citation said that the CMS tends to agree with the RUC recommendations like 90% of the time each year. The other group to be aware of is MedPAC. This is a group that was formed in 1997 by Congress. They basically made a group to help them understand Medicare and the challenges that may be coming. And so this is a group that runs reports, they do research, and they issue a lot of resources. But essentially, they advise kind of Congress on how to make changes going forward in Medicare as issues arise. Again, not a comprehensive list, but I wanted to point these two groups out as they come up often. Next, people should be aware of the parts of Medicare. I think a lot of people have heard of this. There's parts A, B, C, and D. Part A is inpatient. It kind of pays for a lot of those services. Those are all kind of valued in a specific way. And I'm not going to cover those here because most radiation oncology services are actually part B. B is outpatient services. And so that does cover like most of the care that we deliver. It also covers things like physical therapy and other outpatient services of other specialties, stuff like that. Part C is Medicare Advantage. You guys can have fun with that. We'll come back to that one a little later. And then Part D is drugs. So again, today, really focusing on Part B, that was the focus of the advocacy day and kind of the topics that we'll talk about today. So before we talk about how people are paid out of Medicare, I actually wanted to look and just see how is Medicare funded. I didn't know this. I hope that doesn't make me a bad American. But basically, the Medicare fund comes from two different sources. There's the Hospital Insurance Trust Fund that covers mainly Part A. And that's actually funded by payroll taxes. So you and me, half are paid for by the employer, half by the employee. The other source is the Supplementary Medical Insurance Trust Fund. And these are funds that are authorized by Congress, and they help
supplement the Medicare program that can't be covered by the hospital insurance trust fund. And then where does the money go? It really goes to any provider or physician that is giving a service and billing Medicare. So for us, it's like a radiation oncologist. The hospital is associated with us. If you send to a physical therapist, they may be billing Medicare. Again, any provider. Okay, so the first bill, the one that's primarily pushed by the AMA, this is HR 2474. That bill focuses primarily on Part B and how physicians are paid out of that part. Each year, CMS publishes what's called the Medicare Physician Fee Schedule, and they have a payment rate formula. So this is basically the book on how physicians are going to be paid for that year. That formula is actually nicely covered by Jason Bechta and on the Out of the Basement podcast and RVUU. I'll actually link to that, but briefly, just for the purposes of discussion, the payment, the final payment in dollars, it basically comes from a combination of an RVU or a relative value unit and then a conversion factor. They're multiplied together. So the RVU, as you'll hear on his podcast, is broken into three parts. You take the work RVU, the practice expense RVU, and the malpractice RVU, and then you multiply by the conversion factor, and that gives you the dollar amount for the service. And as I mentioned before, each service is coded. So as a radiation oncologist, you'll do a lot of services throughout the day. These include seeing patients, checking images, managing SBRT, seeing OTVs. All of these things have a specific payment amount, and they're billed out by your company or your practice to Medicare, and then they pay you for that. The focus here is really on the conversion factor, which you can see by the formula is a really powerful factor where it's just a multiple that can increase or decrease the amount of pay that the physician sees based on their services. It's actually pretty cool. The AMA has a write-up of conversion factor history. I'll link it here in the show. It just kind of shows you how this conversion factor has been used differently throughout history to kind of adjust physician pay. And it's pretty political. I'd actually suggest that you go read about it. I'm not really going to kind of cover it here, but the key is it's this factor that can be used in a powerful way to adjust cost and pay. Now, the concept is actually deeply very complicated, but the message from the AMA is pretty straightforward. So you can definitely rabbit hole this, but you don't have to. It's kind of easy to understand the overarching point. At the end of the day, there is a push and pull. The U.S. population is aging, and there are more and more people joining Medicare, and the cost of care is getting expensive, and so there are concerns about funding. But at the same time, we have inflation, we have increased costs of running a practice, and it's become very challenging for physicians to provide care in this inflationary environment. So one idea to revise Medicare in the way that physicians are paid, given this environment, was to use the conversion factor and kind of link it to inflation. So if inflation goes up, then the conversion factor goes up, and then appropriately the pay that the physicians receive go up to kind of make it equal given the environment that they're in. Now, again, very complicated, but it's worth noting that MedPAC actually agrees with this, and they do recommend that there's some adjustment made to kind of recognize that inflation is really rising costs for physicians and making it hard to run practices. And so, like, I'm not quoting anyone specifically, but I walked away from this advocacy day feeling like this was well supported in Congress. And if this passes, you would ask, what does this mean for me? Well, for that, my friends, I'd say it depends. In radiation oncology, it probably doesn't mean it goes into your pocket, but it does mean that your practice would be more well-funded. And that's really it. On its face, it's not really that complicated, but of course you could have many hours of podcasts about the pros and cons of different approaches. I'll link the letters. There's an AMA framework for rational Medicare that I think is really nice. It's actually signed by ASTRO and ACRO. I'll link that as well. That kind of gives a more kind of 30,000 foot view of what they think should change to make Medicare better for physicians. And then also, of course, I'll link the actual bill itself, but really all it says is that they will toss the conversion factors and they'll basically instead use a factor that considers inflation. Specifically, they want to go back to the MEI, the Medicare Economic Index. And this is a factor that was used in the past to help kind of link physician pay to inflation. They would like to bring that back. And for us, maybe we'll bring that back to another show because the details of the MEI are out of the scope of this episode. Little wordplay to close out the topic. All right, so our second and final topic for this episode
is actually what we spent the most time discussing during the advocacy day, which is the bill HR 3674, or Providing Relief and Stability for Medicare Patients Act of 2023. So to get this bill, we have to introduce two more concepts about Medicare. These are the sites of service and how that affects payment, and the difference between a professional and a technical charge. The sites of service is just a code that you get that designates the type of facility where the care is delivered in Medicare, and that does affect kind of how the payments work. I'll link the list of the sites of service, but they're pretty extensive. I think my favorite one was code 16, which includes a campground. And I started wondering, can I put a LINAC on a campground? Anyway, that's probably, yeah, we shouldn't go that direction. But this is relevant to radiation oncology because in our field, you can either deliver services in a hospital-based department or a freestanding department. And I'm sure there are other options, but those are the two that you'll hear a lot about. I'm definitely not an expert about how these sites of service are designated, but I work in a hospital-based department. I'm like attached to a hospital. And then a freestanding department would be like a freestanding office that a physician might own. And then maybe they own the machine as well. Again, definitely not trying to say I kind of understand how this exactly works, but this designation does impact the pay. Now, to understand the relevant part of that, you have to understand the difference between a technical charge and a professional charge. A professional charge is a charge that a physician gets for the work that they're doing in rendering the healthcare service. So in radiation oncology, a good example would be like at the end of the day, if I review setup imaging like cone beams, that's a charge and that's a professional charge that represents my work. Now, again, in my job, it's not like that money goes straight into my pocket. It really does vary based on how the contracts are structured, but that's the concept. Conversely, technical charges are supposed to represent the costs that the facility incurs for delivering the care. So like in our field, it would be the cost of running the LINAC, the physicists, the nurses, any kind of equipment that we use, all of those things. Just to full circle back to my example, it's kind of like the professional charge is given to the physician for reviewing the cone beam. And then additionally, there's a technical charge that's collected by the facility for performing the cone beam. Now, the way that these two concepts interact is that the site of service determines how the technical and the professional charges are distributed to the different parties that are involved in delivering care. Now, it's really important to understand that this system has a very long history. There's like a lot of political background behind it. And all of those original intents of how this program were described may or may not best serve the current status of healthcare industry today. And so you'll hear people talk about this. When you hear them talk about site neutrality, what they mean is that in radiation oncology, freestanding and hospital-based clinics are paid differently via different systems. In the freestanding setting, the setup is that the doctor both renders the service, they do the reading of the cone beam, but they additionally own and manage the equipment that does the cone beam. So they get both the professional and the technical charge. And both of those charges are paid out of the MPFS because they both go to, quote, physicians. And in the hospital-based setting, those physicians are paid the same professional fee for reading that cone beam. But the assumption here is that the hospital owns, manages the machine, and does the cone beam, so they receive the technical charge. The reason that things aren't neutral is because that technical charge is calculated separately for hospitals outside of the MPFS. So the USPA put together a letter that they sent to MedPAC, and they set up the problem really well. Right at the top of the executive summary, they show a figure. And the idea is basically that, as we just discussed with the AMA bill, the physician fee schedule really has not been keeping up with inflation, so pay has been quite low over time. Conversely, if you look at the trends for skilled nursing facilities or outpatient hospitals, like in our case, the outpatient hospital departments, or inpatient hospitals, their pay, those technical fees, have more kept up with inflation. The other issue that they outline is that within the RUC, there's been a revaluing of RVUs to try to adjust for the fact that radiological, non-surgical procedural, that's like radiation oncology, and surgical specialties tend to make a lot more money than primary care specialties. So things like, you know, generalist or primary care, psychiatry, those kinds of things. Again, there's a lot behind this, so I encourage you to rabbit hole and kind of go read about that restructuring. But that's been something that's been going on. So the idea is, like, if you're a freestanding practice, you're sort of facing dual headwinds. You have your technical expenses, so the cost of running the machines, that is not keeping up with inflation. And then in addition, there's been a restructuring of physician pay that has resulted in cuts to the professional charges. So I'd strongly encourage you to read the entirety of this letter for all the background. But this kind of effect is happening, again, in specialties that have freestanding practices that have high equipment costs or like high-tech specialties. The examples they give are cardiology, radiology, radiation oncology, vascular surgery. So what does HR 3674 do? What it's requesting is an increase in the non-facility practice expense relative value unit. So that PE, relative value unit, it wants to increase it over the next 2 years, 10% in 2024 and 15% in 2025. And this would be focused on those specialties. That list before was not a complete list, but radiation oncology would be one of those groups. The other thing that's really cool about this bill is that it forces a report. So the Comptroller General of the United States has to tell Congress in a report some factors about the Medicare physician fee schedule and patient access. One of the factors is actually an analysis of the number of healthcare providers furnishing specified services. So are we going to find out finally the ground truth of how many radiation oncologists there are? No, but seriously, they're going to kind of review the system with particular attention paid to this kind of site setup where there's different systems by different sites of service, and then making sure to account and pay attention to things like access. And again, this bill is being supported by the United Specialists for Patient Access, and then ACRO and ASTRO have also supported the bill. So one other last little point to leave you with this bill is USPA actually makes an argument in their letter that the changes that I've just described to the MPFS, the different payment systems, and the inflation have been correlated with a redistribution of services and practice ownership from private physician-owned to hospital or health system-owned. And so the idea is that this bill would provide more stability to freestanding practices financially, and it might try to help curb a lot of the consolidation that's happening in the healthcare system. That issue specifically could be a whole show on its own. Maybe I'll have like Becta and Todd come on or something and talk about it. Super fascinating. They do state it's just a correlation, but I just thought it was a pretty interesting point made in their letter. So that's it, folks. That's the two bills, HR 2474, HR 3674. So a couple of thoughts. I can't really emphasize this enough, but it's sort of a little difficult to take these bills as a concept and understand how they might affect my job 5 or 10 years from now. I do know that I believe that physicians should be better funded, hospitals should be better funded in being able to deliver care and support our aging population. So I do generally support the concept of these adjustments to Medicare and how these practices are paid. As I mentioned, I'm not in a freestanding practice, but I also believe that if there are more centers that are open and healthy, it's just going to be better for our modality and more patients will have access to radiation, which we all agree is super important in cancer care. Plus, I have friends that work in freestanding centers. And so generally, I do support these. What have I done? I did the advocacy day. I encourage you to seek out those days and try to do them. I believe you can do them with ASTRO, ACRO, and the ACR. ASTRO does have a form on their website where you can write your congressperson about HR 3674 and encourage them to include it in the end of year Medicare legislation. You can also join societies and become active in advocacy that way. Listen to our podcast episode of Join Lou. He kind of does a great job explaining how he's made a career of that. And that's it for the experiment. Thank you very much for listening. I really appreciate it. Please send some feedback. You can write on Twitter to Similari or write us at photon@coldlight.org. I want to keep doing these. I'd be curious what you all want to hear about, if I should bring on some guests, and we'll keep going forward. Thank you all very much for listening. I greatly appreciate you all. Have a good night. Thanks for listening.
If you liked our show, please subscribe and leave us a rating. Also, head to photonmedia.org and check out the rest of our content. We hope you're having a great day and look forward to seeing you again soon.